The most important part of being happy and healthy is being honest with the people you love. Lynette from The Client List. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Felonious Pundits. I am Kentad Svensgaard, and along with me, as per usual, please say hello to Mr. AJ Mass.
Hello, hello, hello. It is I here, ready to get started on, an epic tale of spurned love, unearned love. Adjourned love.
yeah, what an episode we have. But folks, if you're new here, let me just let you know real quick. Felonious Pundits is a podcast about the television program Criminal Minds. Each week we recap and take an in-depth look at an episode of the show. I have never seen the show before, so I'm going to be giving it a first watch perspective. And AJ is our grizzled veteran who has seen each and every episode many times, so that's the viewpoint he'll be giving to you all. This week we are talking about Season 4, Episode 16, entitled very cleverly, Pleasure is My Business. Pleasure is My Business. This was written by Owen Lee and directed by Charles S. Carroll. Originally airing on February 25th, 2009. AJ, if I had an alternative title for this episode, I'm going to reference Xaviera Hollander and call this episode The Unhappy Hooker.
Very nice. Very good. The Unhappy Hooker. I, of course, went a different route with this and decided to name this one Megan the Rapscallion.
yes, indeed. So let's get into the episode, shall we? We're going to open this week at a luxury hotel suite in Dallas, Texas. And we see a woman in a state of undress. And she is wearing her cowboy hat, her boots, and her undergarments, and that's about it. And we quickly discern and learn that she is with an older businessman type. And clearly at this moment, she is the business.
She is pleasure. Yes. Very racy for CBS. Not racy for the grand scheme of things, but for CBS, this is quite racy.
Agreed. She brings him over some champagne and she gets on with the sexy talk, telling him to like let her know what he wants. And he whispers in her and she says she can comply. He whispers to her and says he can comply.
That would be a completely different episode.
Right. But rather than actually complying with what he wants, she walks away from him and her attitude sort of changes here. And meanwhile, she just coldly starts to take a call from her next client as we realize that this guy is now sprawled out on the floor, apparently dying from whatever poison she has just given him in his champagne.
Yeah, totally. We learn a lot when we watch the show that women, if they're going to be serial killers, tend to poison. That tends to be their MO, and we're certainly seeing an example of this. She gave him such disdain throughout this entire, I mean, this is only like a minute and a half sequence, but like, you know, she starts the episode, she's like, hi, tiger, basically. And then it's just like, for the rest of it, it's like, ugh, will you die already? Just her eyes, just her face, like, will you just die already?
Oh, Megan is such a rapscallion. We cut over now to Hotch, and he is in his office. He happens to be looking at a clip of Jack on his bike, lest we forget Hutch has a son and an ex-wife out there.
Yeah, I mean, and we're joking a lot about the adult movie kind of tone. It looks like even though Hutch is living by himself now without wife and son. The types of movies he prefers are those of his son, actually, just living life. So I guess, okay, good on him.
Yeah, good for Hutch. So basically, after we feel sorry for Hutch a bit, he gets a call, and it's from the Attorney General out in Dallas. And he's asking for Hutch to come out and investigate this murder case. The thing is, he's not asking for the BAU team. He's just asking Hutch. He won't give him any details. He's just like, can you please just come out? And it's not really the unsub that he's worried about. It's all the lawyers and the political. Apparently, this case he's got, you can tell it's going to be some kind of political muckety muck that they're going to get involved with.
Really? From Texas? I find that impossible to believe.
Hard to believe as it is. It is what our case is going to be this time. So we cut over next immediately to Hutch walking with the Attorney General in the hotel. The Attorney General is explaining to Hutch that the victim is some big-time corporate guy named Hoyt Ashford. He's a lot of things. He's a hedge fund manager. He's a talk show guest, yada, yada, yada. Rich, powerful. We get the picture. His lawyers want to say that he's committed suicide. Obviously, Hutch knows this is not the case. They get to the room. They see sort of the evidence that is loitered around, and Hutch holds up a packet, apparently, which was of some Viagra. And he's saying most guys, if they're about to off themselves, they're not going to take some Viagra before that.
As far as we know. I mean, I don't want to kink shame anybody, but that does seem a bit odd.
Right. And basically, we find out that Hoyt Ashford has a wife and kids at home. And this situation that we have set up was very clearly an illicit dalliance of a guy and his call girl. And we're obviously talking about a high-end prostitute here, because the Attorney General lets him know every Wednesday, basically he had an account that he would take $10,000 out of and spend here on this woman. He called Hutch and he wanted him here alone first because this investigation needs to be kept quiet. There's a lot of big names that may be involved, and we don't really want any of these big names to get caught up in the case just because maybe they're acting on some proclivities that they wouldn't necessarily want out there in the world. Hutch explains that he doesn't really give a rat's patootie about the politics of the situation. And the AG says, hey, if that's fine, but if you make any kind of noise at all, we'll just take the FBI off the case and rescind the offer, the request for help. So then they're walking towards the elevator in the hotel lobby, and the door opens up, and wouldn't you know it, our unsub, our prostitute, is on the elevator, and she's sort of paying attention to her surroundings and hears the Attorney General thank Agent Hotchner. She's dressed in a sharp business suit at the moment. She looks quite professional. So it's just her now and Hotch on the elevator. And she tries to spark up a little small talk with Hutch, but it's Hutch, so obviously she's not going to get anything out of him in terms of any kind of action. Yeah.
He's not there to flirt, even though she's clearly his type, because she's a Haley type.
Exactly.
I just happen to love the irony of, now, Agent Hotchner, discretion is of utmost importance in this case. We must have full 100% discretion. Elevator doors open. And here is the name of the victim, Agent Hotchner, that we don't want out in the public. Right. Which is the only reason that she is aware that the FBI is there at all, is because Captain Discretion was not discreet.
And he's the Attorney General for the state. Like, you would think maybe perhaps he's known, especially to somebody that's like a high-end prostitute.
At least he's not a client. I mean, that would have been a whole other layer of...
Yeah, hey, Jerry! Wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
So anyway, we follow her as she gets off the elevator before Hutch does, and as she's walking down the hallway, she's immediately starting to undress. I'm like, really? She wouldn't wait to get to the room. She's got to prep herself for whoever her next client is. And she lets down her hair and she heads to her next customer's room as we go into credits.
Criminal minds.
We come back and we're seeing the BAU jet fly in. Hotch gives us our opening quote. The prostitute is not, as feminist claims, the victim of men, but rather their conqueror, an outlaw who controls the sexual channels between nature and culture. Camille Paglia.
Not a surprise at the source of that quote.
Makes sense. Reed is on the jet with the rest of the team, obviously because Hotch is already in Texas. And he's explaining to us and the team that the female serial killers are different than the male serial killers. They don't have a lot of information on female serial killers because there are not as many of them. And they tend not to have signatures like the torture or the taking of trophies that we normally see. Because in these cases, there's usually it's not about sexual gratification. It's actually just about killing whoever the victim is, unlike most of the nutso male serial killers out there who get some kind of sexual coefficient out of a killing. And JJ said, so basically what you're saying is women are better at killing, efficient at it.
More efficient, they get away with it more because they probably were probably doing it much more than the men actually. And
yeah, we win. So they start to go over the possible various different possible stressors that could get someone of a call girl nature stressed. What would be reasons that they would kill? And Hotch says, because he's on the phone, I should mention. She's probably poisoning the victims before they have sex. And it's been established that poison is the MO. So he's letting them know that fact. And they also note that she had a very high price tag, $10,000. That means that the persons weren't just paying for sex. They were paying for discretion and keeping things on the down low. She'd probably be a repeat partner of these guys. She'd have repeat customers. She seems to be very methodical. She's deciding, which clients she will kill and which guys she won't. They decide that if these guys are super freaky deaky, well, they're going to be going to great lengths to hide it. And everything that their companies can do to hide it, they will do as well. Because obviously, you don't want your company involved in any kind of sexual scandal.
Discretion. Everybody wants discretion.
Mm-hmm. JJ mentions Hoyt Ashford's wife. She wants to talk to them. Hopefully they can get some information out of her. But the hedge fund that he ran already released a statement saying that he's died peacefully in his own home. And that's interesting, that wording, he's died peacefully in his own home, because as Reed points out, the press release on the first victim had basically the exact same language on the statement. It sounded like the same person wrote the statement for these two different companies.
And I will say, it's change it up a little bit. I mean, if not for the fact that the BAU is investigating a potential serial killer and notice these things, it probably would not have been noticed. But use the same words. Someone might put two and two together. Just synonyms can be your friends.
Exactly. We next cut to a male body that's sprawled out on a hotel bed, and we pan over to empty champagne glasses, and we think, oh no, she's got another one.
Victim number three. I see a bare foot.
Yeah. But actually, as we see our unsub there, we see her go to wake up the guy. So this was just a big fake out. He's not actually dead or anything. And she says to him, guess what? If you leave now, you can get your kids to school, because he's kind of freaking out. Like, what time is it? Oh, what's going on? And so she basically gets him up and ushers him off. He makes a hasty exit. And so she's got time to go over to her computer. And then we get a quick flashback of her on the elevator hearing Hotch's name. So then she opens up that well-known search site, Finder Spider, spider with a Y instead of an I, so clever. Spider, ha ha ha. And I'm glad she I see that she's using proper syntax in her search. She's using an and search. And I was very impressed. And she looks for
It does show that she's, you know, pretty intelligent.
Mm-hmm. And she looks up Hotchner plus FBI. And she gets several hits. So she reads, she's doing her research on Hotch. She opens up a video of him at a press conference.
From six episodes ago, season 4, episode 10.
Yeah. We get, okay. She's intelligent. She heard Hotch. She's doing her research on him. We cut next over to Prentice and Morgan, and they're interviewing Hoyt Ashford's wife. And the whole thing, I felt it was kind of cringe, AJ, because of how he died, basically. It's very uncomfortable, this whole interview, because, you know, Hoyt didn't die at home peacefully and asleep.
But she knows, and they're tap dancing around the subject, but eventually we just, you know, it's like, look, I was with him when I was 20. He likes them 20. I'm no longer 20, you know. So it's not like they were trying to get this woman who was just like, oh, he was very loyal to me for 40 years.
Right.
You know, she's significantly younger than him as the wife.
Right. And that's what he likes, younger women. And now that she's aged out of his bracket, she was aware of, you know, he was paying for stuff on the side. So she's not shocked, but it's still, it's pretty a sad relationship, a statement on their relationship, basically.
Yeah, although, I mean, if she, actually, I don't feel sorry for her at this point, because it's like, she's known for so long. This is actually freeing for her, probably. She's like, oh, great, now I don't have to pretend. Like, I just get the money. I hope the will, you know, was all in order. And sure, you know, this guy was so wealthy, $10,000 a week didn't mean anything, but, you know.
Right. Yeah, good point.
Good on Mrs. Ashford.
So we now, we're going to cut over to Hotch, who was waiting to meet the lawyers for both of these victims. But the lawyers don't show up. Instead, there's one woman, and she introduces herself, and it's Ellen Daniels. And she
what's is based
Ellen Daniels. And she is basically a consultant, and she's a lawyer, but she's a consultant. She identifies herself as a problem solver. So basically, she's the Dallas version of Olivia Pope.
Oh, please. How dare you besmirch Olivia Pope this way?
She's a problem solver.
Yeah, it's been handled. Yeah, sure. Low rent Olivia Pope, not even wearing a white suit. gladiators around her.
Yeah, and she tries to play hardball like maybe Olivia would with Hotch, but Hotch very quickly plays. You can't mess with Hotch in the way she's trying to mess with Hotch. You know, I'll just file injunctions, and you'll have to take a year going through the court cases before you. And Hotch isn't gonna play that kind of game.
Yeah,
and
I'll just arrest your ass right now. So just
yeah, just exactly. Yeah, so he wants the call girl's phone number, even if it's not the call girl in this case. He wants anybody's number so that he can talk to him and just, like, try to build some leads, and she's going to help him, basically, is what he's telling her.
Well, I love the way she gets to help him, where she just goes, do you want to buy a house?
Yes.
And he's like, no, I don't want to buy a house. I think, like, Hotch, man. Like, I get that Hotch is Mr. Cole, but, like, she's clearly giving you a code or something. No, I think you want to buy a house. As she hands him the card of a realtor.
Yeah, and clearly, yeah, Hotch is not really, he's not even playing the game. She should have just said the thing, like, at that point, she should have just said, look, I have a madam, and this is her phone number. Take it.
No, see, this is the one thing I actually like of her. She is such a Olivia Pope that she's afraid she's getting recorded. at all times. She is not going to do that. She is going to say code, code, code. But Hashim picked up on that.
No. So next we're going to cut over to Prentice and Reed. They're arriving at what appears to be an open house in some kind of glitzy, nice neighborhood. And Prentice doesn't get what's going on because she said Hotch wanted to meet with them and that they were going to meet up with a madam. Reed then goes on to explain the obvious connections that there are between real estate and prostitution.
They're great long-term investments. Like, really? Yes. That's the path we're going for?
And in fact, he lets her know that the brownstone she has used to be owned by a gigolo. And before we could get into that story, which I really kind of wanted to get into, they get to the door and, hey, a sighting, a Nora Dunn sighting.
Nora Dunn!
yes, Nora Dunn from SNL, for those of you who perhaps
are not as old as we.
Yes. Don't go that far back, is playing the madam here. She's great. I've always liked her, but anyway, very brief scene here for her. And she's like trying to sell it off like they're here to see the house. And very clearly, like right away, Prentice and Reed are not good at sort of faking as they go into the house.
Come on, put on an act before we even get inside. Now I'll close the door. We can talk. Prentice like, you are a madam, right?
Yes. Like, come on, Prentice. Yeah. So basically, Nora's purpose here is to let us know that, yes, she knows about the murders. It's obviously very terrible for her business. But it's not one of her girls. No respectable madam, obviously, would be letting one of her girls kill off all of their clientele. That would not be a good business plan for them.
Good point. Very good point.
So they figure that the unsub is not likely working for a service. Then we go over the fact that the most important document that any of her girls could have is her client list. This is the thing that keeps them in business, and it represents not only their daily income, but their end of job income as well, because they sell off their lists apparently once they decide they're going to get out of the business. And Reed is kind of in a fumbling, bumbling manner of his own, asking about specific sexual acts that these men may have been killed for. Nora Dunn is again has to point out, look, why would a man pay five figures for an escort? It's not just about sex. Though that does need to be, you know, that does need to be involved. That needs to be, they need to be good at that. But these guys are also there for basically therapy. They need someone they can tell all their secrets to, give all their dirt to, someone they can talk to about things like that they couldn't talk with their wives about. So this case is probably not about what these men do in bed. It's what they do out of bed. And during all of this, of course, we've been watching our unsub meet up with some guy at an office, and she's taking his clothes off and tying him to a chair. She's being dominant. The guy's being very submissive. He's kind of into it. She forces a drink down his gullet. She tapes his mouth up, and then he slowly starts to realize that this is gone. Like, he doesn't even have an opportunity to say a safe word. AJ's got tape all over his mouth.
Yeah, I think the safe word he was looking for was epicac.
She watches as
he... She watches in an evil, like, she's mocking him. He's, like, grassy for air. She's like, ooh, are you getting fair?
Yeah, exactly.
Horrible.
And then he dies, and we cut to a bit later. There's a security guard opening the elevator, and the elevator door opens, and we see this guy, and he's taped up to a chair. He's got big X's written in lipstick over his eyelids. So that's our freaky next crime scene, basically. So we cut to a bit later, and Morgan, Hotch, and Rossi have arrived. We're talking about our new victim. His name is Joseph Fielding. He was the CFO at whatever company they're at. He was poisoned, and his body was staged in the elevator. It was clear that the lipstick was put on his eyes post-mortem after he was dead. And so they start talking about how now our unsub is off book. B because now there's this big signature, oh, with the X's on the eyes, when there was no signature before, and also female killers aren't supposed to do this. So perhaps she's playing or toying with the FBI. This is specifically for the FBI.
Well, I mean, even if that wasn't the case, I mean, she killed these two people, and the corporate statements was, oh, died in his home, oh, you know, So even if the FBI wasn't involved, it's like, hey, maybe she wants people to not be able to send out one of those corporate statements. Like, no, he's dead. And it wasn't, right. Oh, peacefully in his sleep. Splashy, splashy.
Yeah, good point. A man comes up to Hotch and introduces himself as Larry Bartlett. He is a lawyer who represented Mr. Fielding for his company, Webster Industries.
The most stereotypical foghorn, leghorn person I've seen on this show in some time. I just want to talk to y'all for a minute here. We're going to use discretion, right?
Yeah. Basically, he just wants to be there and make sure that they're not going to talk about anything and they're not going to go public. Hotch is about to kick him out, but first he takes Rossi and Morgan aside. They talk about, you know what, we weren't going to go public with any of this information anyway, right? So we might as well use this guy to act like, you know, hey, we're doing you a big favor here.
He doesn't know that we don't want to release it. So, oh, no, we have to release it. Please don't release it. No, we must release it. Totally play this.
Right. Because basically they know that their killer needs some sort of validation. And if they give it to her, then maybe if they don't give her that validation of the case, she might make some bigger mistake. So basically what you said, like, hey, I killed somebody and it was big and splashy, but now if we don't all of a sudden see it on the news, we're not giving her what she wants. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So now we go back to the office, and this guy, Larry, has given them everything he could on Fielding, and they're going over all of the information on him. This guy's apparently super rich, super kinky. He's a jerk. He's been married like four times, and he would do everything he could as rich as he is, he's doing everything he can to get out of paying his ex-wife's alimony and child support. And they realize a connection with Ashford, who was also married a few times. And so Garcia is on with them, and she lets them know that actually all three of the victims were in the middle of bitter court battles over how much they pay and alimony and child support. And even when they were ruled against in the courts, they would just not pay anyway. They would. So.
One justice for all of us.
Yeah. Of course, Hotch says, okay, let's generate a list of all of the Dallas CEOs who are holding out on paying their ex-wives.
Clickety clack, clickety clack.
Yeah. Meanwhile, these guys are clearly very narcissistic, self-absorbed, and are trying to avoid taking care of any of their paternal responsibilities. And they would then pay call girls. And maybe all of this information came out as pillow talk. And maybe someone who came from a broken home and had none of the things these guys would be complaining about would consider this triggering, but something doesn't seem to be working out about that theory. But anyway, JJ wants to know that if they should get the police together for a profile, and the Hotch is like, no, I think a profile is actually going to work, and I don't think going public in this case is going to work either. But what we should do is talk our profile to the lawyers of these guys, get these guys involved so that they know what they're looking for. Something strange is there, and they might protect their clients in this case.
Very clever way to get a profile sequence into the show when there's no reason to give a profile. kudos to the writers on this one.
Yes, so we get a profile scene, and instead of cops, it's a bunch of paralegals, you know, taking notes and asking some doofy questions. Some not so bad, but it's basically the profile scene, but not given to cops.
Yeah, it's a yada yada scene. It's basically recounting everything that we already have been heard throughout the episode. Yes, they have secrets. She knows the secrets. They don't want the secrets to get out. That's why we have to stop her. Please, anything, tell us.
There is a young woman there named Allison Barnes, who is a lawyer for Webster Industries. And she says, oh, by the way, I can give you something like the secret penthouse he had for help out. Like, maybe that would be some kind of help to the case.
Oh, and man, the look that she gets from Foghorn Leghorn when she first speaks up, though, she's like, I think I might have something. What? Don't you dare.
Yeah.
She was fired how soon after, you think?
I don't think she was there within the next hour, AJ. I think she was gone. So now we're going to cut to another businessman, and he's sitting in a hotel lobby looking around nervously. And he's even like knocking over a glass of water. He's clearly, he seems out of place. And this whole meeting that comes up doesn't seem like his normal course of business, as our unsub comes up to meet him. And we find out that this guy's name is Trent. And she's explaining to Trent that nothing is going to happen that day, that she's actually just going to chat with him. And this guy, Trent, he actually seems pretty decent. Turns out he's not cheating on his wife. We find out that he's a widower. And our unsub does seem very sympathetic to him as she says, don't worry, you got nothing to worry about. I understand. Basically, she's sort of...
Yeah, she brings it up. She's the one who figures it out real fast, especially because he's nervous and he's not like these cocky guys that we see right in the other scenes. And she's like, when did your wife die? Like, she gets him to talk about it. And she's very, very much like, look, you can't F this up. You're paying me. No. Don't worry about it. You can't say the wrong thing. It's all good.
Meanwhile, we cut to our team busting into the penthouse. But once they get it clear, they realize no one is there. And then we cut back to Trent and our unsub. And he's telling her he almost didn't come because of that thing that his lawyers told him. And she's like, whoa, wait, what?
What thing would that be?
And he says, you know, there's this girl like you, apparently.
Trent.
Who's been out there killing her clients? And now our unsub is like, wait, what? And she's a little bit unsettled. She presses Trent for more information. And he says, well, apparently they got to this woman's penthouse. They're on their way to arrest her. And the unsub says, well, if they do, probably a lot of big shot guys will be getting in some trouble, right? Trent doesn't seem worried at all. He says, no. My lawyer thinks that they have the FBI in their pocket. There won't be any kind of issue with any big shot guys. They won't release any names. And she says, oh, how interesting. Well, let's get out of here, Trent. Which is a little surprising because she had just said nothing was going to happen. And now she's saying, you know what? Something's going to happen.
Yeah, something's going to happen. Wink, wink. Nudge, nudge. Come with me. Everything's going to be great. We're going to have a little happy time. Sure. Oh, Trent. Trent. Yeah. Trent. Loose lips.
Yeah. So now we go back to the penthouse, and Morgan and Prentice are searching the place. One thing they find is a purity ring. And it's a ring that a little girl would wear. It's a small ring, so that's an interesting find they have there. Meanwhile, Hotch is finding.
No, I'm just laughing because I've at this point we're you know maybe halfway through the episode at this point, so I'm expecting Rossi to go, that's it, we're looking for a teenager, looking for an 8-year-old girl. Like no. Usually this is the point where they get something completely wrong, but that's not what happens. but I was braced for it.
Yeah, Hutch finds several antique first edition books. Again, we're probably dealing with someone of some kind of intelligence, but also someone of some kind of means, because they're like antique.
Because the books have actually had their spines cracked, which means someone's actually taken the time to read these things. Yeah. Who would do that?
That's odd.
And Reed goes, hey!
Exactly. There's nothing identifiable, though, in there. There's no sense of personality. There's no pictures of family and friends and things like that that would give them some kind of indications of this girl's personal. Her lifestyle seems to be disposable. They determine that maybe this girl isn't actually all faking this privilege. Maybe she actually came from real privilege based on the clues that they're finding here. The phone starts to ring, so they quickly call Garcia to see if she's going to be able to trace this call. And she says she's going to need to have a little time because they didn't have anything in place ready. She didn't know they were about to trace a call.
Yeah, because, you know, when I clickety-clack, it takes me 23 seconds, except when we can't get the answer right now and it takes 3 minutes 52 seconds.
Yeah,
it's always the we're not ready to solve the case excuse with Garcia.
So they're about to have Prentice answer the phone because that seems like it would make the most sense of who she would talk to. But before they even can get Prentice to answer, the answering machine comes on. It's the kind of thing where In the olden days, kids, you used to actually have, you could screen your calls and you would hear the answering machine pick up and you could actually listen before you picked up the call. that was a thing, trust me. So the answering machine picks up and we hear our unsub and she, very scarily to me, it was like, oh, snap, because she says, hey, Aaron, I know you're there. Aaron Hotchner, pick up. What? And everybody kind of looks at each other like, oh, that's kind of freaky. So he picks up the phone. He asks her name. He's like, well, you have me at a disadvantage. You know, you know my name. Who are you? And she says that she thought she could trust him. And Hotch is like, well, who says you can't? She says, I want to trust you. I looked you up online. I thought you were a good person. And Hotch is like, well, I guess I disappointed you. Do I deserve to be punished? And just like all the other men who walked out on their families. And she asks him if he walked out on his family, but he says, actually, no. Well, my wife left me. And she asks if he has kids and he says, yes. And how often does he see them? And she kind of scoffs at him when he says he tries to see them every week, but he also says he doesn't get there as often as he wants. And after a minute, she says, you know what? I believe you. But you shouldn't compare yourself, Hotch, to the men that she sees because he's nothing like them. And meanwhile, this is the point where we cut over to her and she's in a car. And poor Trent. she's got her gun pointed at his head. His mouth is covered in tape. He's sitting in a driver's seat of the car, tied up. And she says to Hotch that he's just another whore. And he asks her, how so? And she says, you come when they call, and then you do all their bidding, which is actually what happened. Because
that she knows that. You come when they call and take the elevator. And
yeah,
stay high.
Exactly. We flash back, actually, to Trent telling her that they've got the FBI in their pocket. Meanwhile, Garcia is still trying to trace the call. She tells Morgan she needs another 60 seconds. And Hotch says, yeah, he knows that he's frustrating this woman because she wants to show the world all of these bad men and his investigation is just getting in her way. And she says, no, you're not doing your job. You don't even want to arrest me. You don't want me in custody because you're in their pocket. You just want me to disappear just like they do. And Hotch is like, no, we want to find you. He explains he understands she's been betrayed so many times. She doesn't know who she can trust. And that's actually why her first murder felt so good. But each one after that has left her less and less satisfied. And he says, am I right? She says, yes. He tells her, look, turn yourself in. I'll get you help. I won't let anyone make you disappear, because that's clearly what she's worried about at this point, is just being erased by these powerful men. And she says, I wish I could believe that, but she's not going to let them get away with covering things up. And at this point, she shoots poor Trent in the head. Nice blood splatter. This is when she's got her white suit on, yes. Of course. And then we hear Morgan, oh, no, what's good? Garcia's like, oh, did I? So what was that? It was a shot. Oh. And then back in the parking lot, that our unsub is on the phone, walking coldly away from the crime. And she's on the phone and she's actually calling the media to tell them that she heard gunshots and gives them the address of where it was.
Which is very clever.
Yeah.
You know, she's not stupid. This is not a stupid unsub. This is maybe a troubled unsub who is unraveling, but she's not stupid.
So by the time the BAU team arrives at the scene, the local news media has already beaten them there and they have to get through the media to get to the crime scene. We get some quick flash cuts to the shot dead Trent, and then we go to a commercial. We come back, we're at the police station, and the team is trying to listen to the call from our unsub again. And Reed is like, her use of the word whore suggests that she's trying to disassociate herself from her actions. Prentice points out that she's becoming more personal. She's changed her MO. She shot somebody now. JJ notes, and the victimology seems to be different here because Trent was a faithful guy to his wife before she died. Morgan's like, it's clear she's devolving. At this point, she could be taking out anybody. And Hotch says to Reed, let's go back to the tape and let's listen to the part just before she pulled the trigger. And he does. And he wants to find out who the they is. She mentioned that want her to disappear. Let's figure out who the they is. Prentice says, well, it could be anyone in a position of power who would like to cover this up. And then Rossi says, well, wait a minute, you mentioned a purity ring that you found, like a tiny ring. That's not something you would get. This sounds more like something a gift a father would give. So maybe we're looking for someone whose father is this dresser here. And JJ says, yeah, if her father was like any of the CEOs, he's probably walked out on her as well, which is very insightful from JJ. And Prentice says, okay, well, you're a rich person. You're sleeping with men. You're selling yourself to these men who are like your father because you're trying to get back at your father. How are you going to find your clients? And they said, well, okay, it's the client list. She probably bought it from another call girl.
Makes total sense, and they could have solved that in about 2 minutes shorter than it took them, but to dance around it, like, I love when they just use these scenes to pad out the episodes. This is definitely one of those instances, because it's just like, hey, you know, Garcia clickety-clacked 15 minutes ago that everybody was behind in child support. Maybe this is someone whose father was behind in child support. Like, why was not an instinctive thing then?
Right.
It took an extra 15 minutes. You know, this one wasn't. Maybe that's the thing. Really, guys? Yeah. Come on. But they get there. They got there.
Yes.
They're there.
So now we're going to cut back to Rossi and Hotch, and they're talking with our problem solver,
Elvin Faniel.
And they're trying to figure out who sold the client list for...
Who sold the Book of Love?
And Ellen is very hesitant to break attorney-client privilege. And she even tries to say, okay, well, I want immunity from my client if I get them to say anything. And again, Hotch really shut her down like hard twice in this episode. He says, no, we're not going to talk about immunity. And he basically threatens her with arrest for obstruction of justice. And while he has that happen, in the meantime, he'll also have the FBI harass all of her clients over his petty white collar crimes and stuff. Like, Hotch just is not interested in games with her.
Look, Hotch has been called out by name this episode by the unsub, and she poked at the "you don't see your son enough." Like,
yeah,
every last nerve is frayed at this point.
Yeah, so Hotch leaves and Rossi looks at Ellen and he's just kind of like, if I were you, I'd take this deal. that was kind of funny. We then cut to Prentice and Morgan. They arrive at some young lady's house. They are looking for someone named Catherine, and the woman is like, oh, you have the wrong house. Clearly, they don't have the wrong house. They tell her right off the bat, hey, look, we don't care about anything you've done. We're actually just trying to find out who you sold your client list to. We see that this woman has a little boy there, and after she looks at him for a moment, she looks at Morgan and Prentice, says, okay, lets them in to talk to her. And she actually has all the details on our unsub. She says the woman's name that she sold the list to was Megan Kane. Her father, Andrew Kane, was one of her regular clients. He's a big business type CEO who works for a company called Ebbett Oil. And he was one of her regular clients for 6 years. And it turns out that Andrew left his own wife for this woman, this Catherine. Of course, as these things are going to not happen, it doesn't work out for them. I wonder why. But she wasn't very surprised when Megan at some point came a knocking on her door. And Prentice is like, well, isn't it strange that Megan would come over and try to go into the same line of work? And she's like, whoa, no. She wasn't trying to go into the same line of work. She really hated me. She blamed me for ruining her life, her parents' lives, her dad. She ruined him, basically. And she figured she would buy the list off her so that no one else would be ruined from this situation. If that makes sense. That's,
yeah, you know, she's going to make her go away. Make her go away. I don't think that really solves the problem.
Yeah.
Because, I think this rich guy, rich daddy, and with his lawyer type fixers, I think he could probably find another one if he wanted. So
yeah.
it's a fool's errand, but gave her some sense of power, I'm sure. Like, haha, dad, look what I can do. So maybe money well spent until she decided to go into the killing.
Yeah. Oops. So we got back to the police station. The team is going over what information they have been able to find on Megan Kane. Basically, her poor parents divorced 8 years ago, and she left the country to travel, and at some point came back. They don't really know when she came back. Meanwhile, they've got the folder open and Hotch is looking at her picture and he realizes that she is the woman that he saw on the elevator. He tells JJ, oh, look, she's got to call Andrew Kane over at Ebbett Oil. We got to go talk to him. So we now cut to Hotch, who's walking with Andrew Kane, and who is there? None other than our fixer, Ellen Daniels. And Andrew is telling Hotch that they clearly have the wrong woman. Hotch is saying, no, they don't. And in fact, we found the purity ring you gave her. And that's evidence because we know that she's who we're looking for. Look, we want to help and we think we can help if you can just get us a way to contact Megan. Andrew Kane ends the meeting. He's saying, he just like, we're done here. This is not going to happen.
I'm rich. You're insignificant. Goodbye.
Yes. And we go back to the station and we see JJ letting Hotch know that they got the tail set up on Kane. So basically Hotch knew what he was doing. He was just trying to get Kane to contact Megan and he knows he's going to try to get in touch with her. And Rossi points out, yeah, even if he doesn't care about his daughter, he cares about his own reputation and his company's reputation. So he's going to be working hard to protect that.
Very dark, but that actually very accurate.
Yeah. We then get Garcia calling in to let them know that Andrew Kane just reserved a room at the Wilmore Hotel. This all seems pretty easy, right? So the team takes off to go to the hotel. And we cut to see Kane, and he's walking down a hotel hallway, card key in hand. And We see now that Hotchin and Morgan are waiting in a hotel room. They're ready to pounce on whoever opens that door. And they radio down Apprentice. She says, oh, yeah, well, we haven't spotted Kane or his daughter yet. And everybody's tense and there's about to be some action going down. We see Kane outside of a hotel room door. He looks around to make sure no one is there. Then he opens the door into the whole hotel room. And then we get the old switcheroo, AJ.
They silence the lambs us.
Yes, they did. Because Hotch and Morgan see that it's Ellen Daniels who walks into the room. And meanwhile, we cut over to Kane, who has gone into a hotel room. And Megan is indeed there. And she says, hello, Daddy, as we go to a break.
Mm-hmm. Boy, what a horrible thing for him to do, to send Ellen Daniels over to basically what he knows is going to be a bust. They could have just started shooting, and he didn't care.
Yes.
He didn't care. Ugh.
So when we come back from break, Kane is there with his daughter, and he's asking her how she could do what she's done. And Megan is like, what did I do? Did I embarrass you? Did I fail you in some way? And he starts to say, well, those were good men. And she lets him know in no uncertain terms that they were not good men. Hoyt Ashford liked to leave bruises. Guess who Michael Stanton liked to watch me with? And she would even ask them about him because she wanted to know, what did these women do that was so much better than her mom? And this immediately gets Kane set off. He's like, shut your mouth, screaming at her, and starts to grab her by the throat. And he catches himself and he realizes, oh, what am I doing here? And she's kind of looking at him like, yeah, they told me this is what you liked. So, yeah, bad news. We cut to our team and they're trying to figure out where the Kanes are. And they're walking along, and for some reason, Ellen Daniels is making the walk with them. Ellen Daniels is doing her best. She can't stay involved. And Hotch says, well, she mentioned when he was talking about Megan, she mentioned that there was ivory marble in the foyer, and that gives Daniels a good reason to be there because she's, oh, that's the Chase Regent Hotel. So she knows the actual hotel where Kane must be. She says he liked it there. He said the staff was discreet. So Hotch says, okay, that's it. We're going to set up a perimeter. Nobody's going to get in or out. We cut back to the hotel room and Andrew is there telling Megan that the FBI knows who she is. She knows that. He tells her he doesn't want her to destroy herself. Look, he can protect her. He can help her get out of the country. And she's like, oh, yeah, fine, of course. Just ship me off. No worries. Like, that's how you deal with all your problems. Just ship them off elsewhere. And he's like, no, look, you're my little girl. I love you. Please, please, please. He begs to let her, let him save her life. And this does seem to get to her. She even says that she's scared. And he's starting to say, it'll be okay, honey. She's tearing up. She starts to hug him. She asks him, will he stay with her? And he promises her, yes, yes, I'll stay with you. And she collapses into his arms. She's crying. And as he's hugging her, says, but...
Wait. Did you hear that? Did you hear that, Kintana?
What was that?
I believe that was the other shoe dropping.
Yes. By the way, I'm probably going to need that client list that you have. And we see from our point of view that this has immediately made Megan like, like, he's not here for me.
Yeah,
he's not here for me. He doesn't love me. This is all about his protection. So she says, okay. He says, look, I'm going to need the client list. I just want to hide it. If the FBI finds it, he tries to act like it's all about protecting her. If they find it, they're going to like be able to pin all of those murders on you. Well, we don't want that. So I'll hide the list. Why don't you get that list for me? She steps away and she goes over to the balcony where she has her bag and she's looking through her bag. as if to get the list. But we then see her flashing back to just a few moments ago when he was grabbing her neck, trying to choke her. So that's what she's thinking about. And
amazing how she can still remember that so vividly.
Yes. And she's starting to grab for her gun. But at that moment, we hear some sirens and she looks over the balcony rail and she sees the BAU SUVs pull up and the police cars pull up and start to run into the hotel. And so she has changed her plan here. And instead of grabbing the gun, she grabs a cell phone and she walks back over to her father and says, here, this is it. This has my contacts, my clients. You see him give a sigh of relief, like, ah, and he takes it and starts to put it in his pocket. And he lets her know, hey, I'm going to see you at the police station. And she smiles at him. She doesn't let on. She's read his number, basically. He gives her a little bit of a fatherly kiss and hug, and he leaves. And then we see Hotch and Morgan approaching the room. They come into the room. They have their guns out and ready. We see that her gun is on the table and next to champagne bottle. We know what happens when this woman gets near champagne.
Yes, we do.
Morgan sees Megan out on the balcony sitting there. He calls over for Hotch. And she has a glass, empty champagne glass. Hotch tells Morgan he can stand down. It's clearly over. She's not putting up a fight at this point. Morgan says, okay, he'll go call 911. And I know they're not 911, but I'm like, aren't you guys 911? Like, yeah, what do you mean you're going to call 911?
I found that took me right out of the scene. It's like, I'll call an ambulance.
Yeah, right.
That's what they should have said. I'll call an ambulance. They will arrest her. She has been subdued. Like, I'll call 911 because she's dying and maybe the paramedics can get here. I'll call paramedics. Yeah. 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 No, I'm with you. I wrote it down too.
Yeah. So then we go over to Hotch walking over to Megan, sits with her on the balcony. She's clearly woozy and out of it. So we sense right away, oh, she has probably drank the champagne.
She drank the champagne. She's killing herself via poison. There's nothing they can do. She's put the gun on the table, which is proof that, you know, she's the killer because they're going to match the ballistics. So, you know, yes, yeah. I did it. Definitely a lot of that. And she wants Hotch to just hang.
Yeah. She seems to be very sad and depressed, thinking that, you know, nothing that she's done is going to change anything. The guys, those same high profile power people are going to just keep doing what they're doing and get away with it. And Hotch says, oh, look, not if I have anything to do with it. Meanwhile, we cut over to Andrew Kane and he's in the parking garage getting into his car. We cut back to Megan, who's asking Hotch, who was it that said you don't pay a prostitute for sex? You pay her to leave afterwards. And Hotch says it was Dashiell Hammett. And I'm going to call that our quote to end the episode.
No, that is a backdoor quote. They do that sometimes. And sometimes I think it's clever. And this one just annoyed me. Yeah. Because it came from out of nowhere. And it just, oh, I happen to have the framing device you were looking for, too.
Yes. She says that quote doesn't make any sense when it's the man who usually leaves first. And then she gives Hotch the memory chip from her phone, and we see in the Andrew in the car realizing that the phone doesn't have the SIM card in it anymore. Ooh-hoo, she's actually kept the list. Meanwhile, back on the balcony, Megan is asking Hotch how his wife could leave him. She says he's the first man that she ever met that didn't let her down. And she asks him to stay with her, just like she did her father, the same way. Stay with me. Will you stay with me? It's kind of sad. I thought it was
kind of sad, but Hotch will. And it's, I mean, this is not the first time Hotch has done this. There's that lady who was, you know, the doctor's like, you know, they told you to lie to her. No, he said we can lie to her. And like, you know, like,
right.
He stayed with her while she died. Like, Hotch, man. He's got some intestinal fortitude to be able to do this.
Yep. And so he stays with her, and she closes her eyes. Meanwhile, we see the police telling Andrew to roll the window down. We start to hear news stories. Oh, the Dallas business world has been rocked by the blah, blah, blah. As a list of bigwigs who frequented prostitutes was found. Andrew Kane has resigned his position. He is basically, so all the hell has broken loose from her releasing the list. That's the last little bit we get as we then cut to Hotch holding Megan's hands as she passes away from the poison she drinks. And then we see Hotch looking sad. And then our episode is over.
Oh, sad ending. Boo.
Yeah. So that was the episode, AJ. What did you think? Let's consult our barometer and actually discuss if we think the team won the show, won the case this week.
Yeah. You know what? I think we have to call this one a push. Did they win? Did anybody win? I mean, you know, yeah, they caught the unsub, kind of, but, you know, she killed herself, and that was kind of sad and had an emotional toll on Hotch, and really, there wasn't much of a case here, really.
Yeah.
They were bad people that were getting killed. I mean, poor Trent, notwithstanding, but he wasn't even the nicest guy.
Right.
You know, they were called in to solve a case that probably could have been solved very easily if the Dallas DA wanted to do his job. He was trying to pass the buck. So I just look, I'm not going to give him a loss because they did catch Megan, but I'm not giving him a win either. This is just, let's just put this behind us and forget it ever happened.
Definitely a draw. Okay. The other thing we like to do after discussing the episode is tease out what our next episode is going to be. So let's do that, AJ. Let's tease it on out.
Oh, let us tease it on out. Are you ready for this one, my friend? No, you are not, but let's just see what we're going to do anyway. What will the plot be of Criminal Minds, Season 4, Episode 17, entitled Demonology? Demonology. Is it A, Garcia can't sleep because she's convinced a demon has moved in next door? Is it B, Hotch becomes concerned when the older brother of a friend of Jack's dies after playing Dungeons and Dragons? Is it C, Prentice reunites with an old friend who brings her a tale of Vatican shenanigans? Or is it D, Rossi gets a visit from a dying priest who asks him to catch the ultimate serial killer, Satan?
Oh. Demonology. This sounds like it's going to be an interesting one. AJ, I really don't know. I'm torn kind of between choice C and D, which actually makes me think it's going to be A or B. So now I'm going to pull a reverse triple Lutz. And I am going to say that we're going to go with A. My reason for this, Garcia, can you read A to me again? Garcia says,
Garcia can't sleep because she's convinced that a demon has moved in next door.
So Garcia's boyfriend is played by Xander from Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Nicholas Brendan. So, and that often deals with demons. So I'm going to go with choice A. Demon Garcia is not sleeping because of demons.
Fair enough. Certainly, Garcia seems to be the type to believe in demons and whatnot. Believes in fairies and pixies and all that stuff. Sure. But no. No, that was good rationalization there. This episode coming up, Todd, is probably the worst episode of Criminal Minds, in my opinion. I think it's the lowest rated on IMDb, but this is quite the absolute stinkeroo of an episode. Not until we get to post season 12, when it jumps the shark, do we come with anything that even approaches how god awful or demon awful. This is going to be when an old friend of Emily Prentice shows up.
No.
Because there are some shenanigans going on in the Vatican, and he needs her help. This one's gonna hurt.
Well, when you put it that way, I cannot wait until our next episode. Folks, that is the show for this week. Thank you so much for joining us. We hope you had a great time. Please be sure to subscribe to, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite podcast platform. And be sure to spread the word and let your friends know about us. You can also write to us at feloniouspundits@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at @podcast_pundits. For AJ Mass, this is Kentad Svensgaard saying goodbye and keep profiling.
Wheels up. Revenge is the single most satisfying feeling in the world. J.R. Ewing.